91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Selesnick. Well, we all have to eat to live, but what we eat, or more importantly, what our ancestors ate tens of thousands of years ago, how they got their food, and when they did, what they did to get it, to make it ready to eat, really can give us a very big history lesson. We're going to talk about the role food plays in history. Then later in the hour, the status of a smoking ban in Kentucky. But first, joining me to talk about the history of food is Northern Kentucky University Professor of History, Dr. Jonathan Reynolds. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Hey, good afternoon, Marianne.
All right. So how in the world did this all get started when you started putting together the history of food with the history of the world?
Yeah, well, I certainly didn't start out as a food historian. And nowadays, you could actually go to graduate school and focus on food history. I'm trained as an African historian, originally working on Islam and politics in West Africa in the 20th century. But when I started at Northern Kentucky University back in 1999, one of the things I was assigned to do was teach world history classes. And I don't remember exactly what year it was even, but I was having a great discussion with my students, which is where most good ideas come from. And we started talking about how world history was different if you looked at it through the lens of food instead of through the lens of politics or the lens of economics or the lens of religion. And that idea just sort of germinated in my brain for a while. And two things happened along the way. One, we have the first year book program at NKU. Like this year, we used Kelsey Timmerson's What Am I Wearing book about, you know, where your clothes come from and how you're connected to the entire world through your clothes. And I was on the committee for that, and I decided, you know, why don't we do something about food for the first year book? And I suggested a cookbook as the first year book. And I found a book called Extending the Table, a World Mennonite Cookbook, which are recipes collected by Mennonite missionaries from all over the world. And so they're actually real recipes that people would actually cook in Cambodia or Botswana or Ecuador or something like that. And I pitched it to the committee, and they shot it down brutally. And I was like, no, you can teach anything with this. You can teach chemistry from food, and you can teach economics from food, and you can teach culture from food. And they shot it down. And I said, well, fine, you can shoot down my book. I'm going to come up with a whole class just on food. And I wound up designing a class, which I'm teaching right now this semester, called World History Through a Dozen Meals. And so every week we take a meal from a different part of the world, and we deconstruct it to see how all those ingredients came to be and how they got to that place.
Wow. So there's a lot going on there.
And
So you gave a talk a week or two ago talking about all of this history.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you start? How far back do you go when it comes to talking about all of the history of food?
Well, that's a great question. And you can go as far back as you want because, you know, living things always eat. And it's one of the things that binds us together on the planet. But I think I'm a big fan of what's called deep history, and that is that history goes far, far beyond the origins of writing or the written record, and that you actually learn so much more about what it means to be human by looking at that huge, you know, the vast majority of human time is actually before writing or before the creation of cities or even before the rise of sedentary agriculture. So if you look at the way early humans, and, you know, that takes us back at least 200,000 years, how early humans interacted with their environment in order to get food, and what they did to the environment to change the food that they ate and made it easier to feed themselves, it teaches you a huge amount about how human beings fit into this planet and the ecosystem.
Well, let's talk about what they started out with. What did people 200,000 years ago eat?
Well, 200,000 years ago, just about all what we call human beings would have been in East Africa. And at that point, they were foragers, so they were hunting and gathering. They would have been foraging for wild grains, and in the region of the East African savannas and such, those probably would have been what later on become millet and sorghum, or in the Ethiopian highlands become teff, which is the world's smallest domesticated grain. And they would have been foraging for various nuts and tubers, what later on become yams in Africa. And they would have been hunting for various critters, mostly deer variants and herbivores like waterbuck and elan and things like that.
So what do we know then about history when you talk about the fact that they were hunters, they were foragers? What does that tell us?
Well, one of the main lenses we have traditionally used to understand human history and the way humans interact with the environment is what I call the man the hunter meme. And that's the idea that the most important things human beings did to sort of become the dominant species on the planet was invent different varieties of pointy objects for killing things. You know, so Clovis points and spears and atlatls and bows and arrows were really the things that transformed human beings to the dominant species on the planet. And while, you know, if you happen to be in a place that has lions or tigers or bears or something, it's good to have pointy objects. Really, by far the most transformative technologies, again, when you look at food seriously and say food is, you know, and how we get food is what defines us as human beings. It's a whole different set of technologies that really allow human beings to become the dominant species. And they're mostly gathering technologies. If you think about it, for example, weaving or making ceramics were probably two of the most important things human beings ever learned how to do. Because if you, I know we're on radio, but imagine yourself out foraging for tiger nuts in the East African savannas, you can only carry so many tiger nuts in your hands. And so if you can create a bag or make a ceramic pot, you can now carry a significantly larger number of tiger nuts or whatever. And you can also store them. So you can begin to establish a food supply that you don't have to actually get up and go get every day. And even more significantly, once you have ceramics, you can start cooking things. And cooking is in itself probably one of the most significant technological innovations people come up with.
So people did not initially cook their food. Everything
was
raw.
No, that's right. And there is a whole raw food movement. Of course, that, you know, says that human beings should stop eating anything that's cooked. And it's part of the sort of paleo diet perspective. I, for one, subscribe to the fact that cooking things is really significant in human history because there's all kinds of stuff you can't eat until it's been processed. Your body can't actually extract the calories from whatever that is. Our human beings are really remarkable in that we have probably the wimpiest teeth and jaws of any critter on the planet. And that's quite possibly a result of having learned how to pre-digest our food through cooking and thus be able to extract more calories from the foods we gather.
One of the things that you talk about is the difference between men and women here. And I think that the story is that women generally are the gatherers and men are the hunters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean in history? I mean, that's true with food, I assume.
Yeah, well, that's our assumption. And it's actually not the strongest assumption we can make. We know that in more contemporary foraging societies, of which there are very few left in the world, really, men do most of the hunting and women do most of the foraging. Now, if women are out foraging and some critter happens by and it's not looking, they'll kill it. And similarly, while men are out hunting, they're probably foraging for the food that they're eating along the way as well. But the really significant point here is that if we assume, and again, it's probably fairly reliable, that women do the vast majority of the gathering, that it's the women who came up with a lot of these really significant early technologies. It's probably the women who came up with weaving. It's probably the women who came up with ceramics for pottery. And to take that just a little bit farther, if it's the women who are really collecting the seeds and the plants and the tubers and such, it's almost certainly the women who also developed sedentary agriculture, which is probably the single most significant transformation in human history.
Define what that is if someone doesn't know.
Well, sedentary agriculture is what we might just call farming. You know, foragers would go out and collect a whole bunch of grain, and then they would bring that grain back to wherever their campsite was, and they would process it. They would grind it, and they might pound it or boil it or eventually even bake it. But sedentary agriculturalists plant the seeds, and then they hang around and take care of the seeds until they grow, and then they harvest them. And so farmers kind of stay in one place while foragers are moving around collecting food from a very wide area. And that transition from foraging to sedentary agriculture takes place all over the world, probably between about 10,000 and about 4,000 BCE.
We're talking about food and how the history of food is actually, and what people ate is sort of the history of people. My guest today is Northern Kentucky University Professor of History, Dr. Jonathan Reynolds. If you'd like to join our discussion, you can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@WVXU.org. Michael's calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Michael. What's your question?
Hi there. My name is Michael Washington, and I'm a colleague of Professor Reynolds.
Hey, Mike.
How you doing, Jonathan?
I'm doing dead.
My question is, in terms of the processing of all of the food now, do you think that that's going to influence the diets of people all around the world, the Western diet, the processing of the way food is being processed and so forth? What's that tell us about the history to come?
That's a great question, although I was happily talking about the Paleolithic period, and now you've brought us all the way up to the bar. No, that's dandy. Well, what human beings do is process food. And I think that we tend to think, and this is a very popular sort of conception right now, that all of a sudden, sometime, you know, in the past 50 years or something, we've started eating processed foods. But human beings have been changing the environment and processing food for the past 10,000 years. Now, it could be that we've crossed some sort of secondary threshold where now we're processing stuff in a way which is fundamentally different from breeding food to produce more calories or processing grain into beer or making bread or something like that, and that through additives and chemicals and such, maybe it's fundamentally different. But I'm not completely sure about that.
Thanks so much for your call, Dr. Washington. We appreciate it. One of the things that you just brought up is beer, and there's certainly a lot of history to beer. Beer is not new.
No, no.
It's been around for a long time. And what role did beer play in history?
Well, there's an argument, and it's a serious argument, by the way, which is called the beer theory of civilization. And it addresses this exact question of why human beings make the transition from being foragers to being sedentary agriculturalists. Because just to give a little bit more background here, it doesn't actually make a lot of sense that people stopped foraging and started being sedentary farmers, because foragers, by and large, were healthier than farmers were. Foragers ate a much more varied diet. When we look at the biological remains, the skeletons of foragers and such, they tend to be larger and healthier looking than farmers who, when people switch to sedentary agriculture, they get skinnier and smaller because they eat much less varied diets. And so one of the questions is, why would human beings go from this pretty healthy lifestyle to being farmers? And farmers are also sick all the time, which is one of the other
things. How do we know that?
Because farmers live in much more densely populated settlements, and they live in villages, actually. That's what happens once we get sedentary agriculture, and villages are surrounded by human waste, and they're people that you can catch stuff from. And so it's really the birth of contagious diseases comes with the shift to sedentary agriculture. As well.
So you were talking about beer.
Beer, back mm-hmm. to the beer. So one of the questions is, why would we go from being happy-go-lucky foragers to being, you know, sickly and not very happy farmers? And the answer to that may very well be beer, because it's really hard to gather enough grain to make beer. Foragers, by and large, cannot produce alcoholic beverages. They can't produce beer. And so the best way to produce beer is to somehow get all those grains to grow in one place so you can collect a large quantity of them. And so the idea here is that it was the desire for beer that actually drove the development of particularly wheat and barley in order to have enough grain to make beer. And the reason for that was that if you could produce beer, you could throw parties. And that created really the first source of social status. Anybody who could command enough grain to make beer became what we might think of as an influential person in these early human societies.
So really, the type of food that you had and what you could provide for others and all of that sort of helped set up what I don't know, early communities were like?
That's exactly right.
So what else was there besides, obviously, beer is influential and just being able to grow grains or those mm-hmm. sorts of things? What other types of food are you looking for as you go back in history?
Well, all foods are fair game. And one of the really great things here is, and one of the, I think is the most interesting things that comes out of all this, is almost nothing that we eat now is what we might think of as natural. Pretty much everything that you can buy at the grocery store in produce, when you look at bananas, when you look at tomatoes, when you look at, avocados, all those things are actually human-created things. They're what we call cultivars. Once upon a time, there was a wild variant of an ear of corn. Ear of corn's probably the best example of them all, actually. But it didn't look anything like what an ear of corn looks like now. Corn actually comes from a wild grass, which grew in the region of Mesoamerica about 10,000 years ago. And it grew to a height of about 2 feet tall. And it had a little stalk on the top that had 8 to 10 kernels on it. And that's called teosinte, by the way. And early human foragers in that region of Mesoamerica took teosinte and over the course of thousands of years turned it into something resembling an ear of corn. And that's true for everything we eat. There's nothing we eat that's, you know, just like growing in the wild anymore.
Well, what about sugar? You said sugar had a huge influence on history.
Oh, yeah. Sugar's phenomenal. And sugar really takes you in out of the realm of just what human beings do with the environment and into the realm of how food can influence politics and economics. Sugar cane, in this case, comes originally from Southeast Asia, probably from Papua New Guinea. Originally. And sugar makes a huge voyage around the world, starting probably about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. It starts moving across the South China Sea. It gets to India, where it is cultivated widely. From India, it moves across the Indian Ocean and into the Persian Gulf and into the region of the Middle East. And by about 1000 CE, there is extensive slave-based agriculture in the region, especially around Basra in southern Iraq, where sugar is being produced commercially. And the reason for that is sugar's really unpleasant stuff to grow. Sugar likes to grow in a swamp, and swamps are places where malaria is endemic. And the very process of cutting and boiling, cutting, crushing, and boiling sugarcane to turn it into grain sugar is really brutal and involves, you know, standing over boiling vats of sugar for days at a time. And following the Crusades, sugar breaks into the Mediterranean, where it is continued to be grown with slave labor, mostly Slavs from the region of the Crimea and the Ukraine. And then with the opening of the Atlantic world in the late 1500s, sugar makes the leap across the Atlantic and really becomes the defining crop in the creation of the Americas. And to jump forward here, to give you a sense of the impact of sugar, sugar provides the demand for about 80% of the slave labor in the Americas up to around 1800. And that slave labor almost all and eventually comes from Africa and results in more than 12 million people being imported as captives to the Americas to grow sugar.
Now, I think most people think it was cotton.
That's a very American perspective on it, in that the sort of latter and most what we think is a stereotypical sort of image of slavery in North America was the growing of cotton, although really slavery gets its start in North America mostly in rice cultivation in the Carolina coasts, and that's actually rice that was initially developed in West Africa. There's a variety of rice that was domesticated in West Africa, and so it was enslaved Africans who were brought to the Carolinas to grow rice initially, and then later sugar this is what happens when you talk to historians, after the development of the cotton gin, which makes cotton more profitable. But it's really sugar that defines slavery in the Atlantic world, in the Caribbean, in Brazil in particular.
What about spices? You know, Columbus came to, ended up in America really in search of spices. Mm-hmm. What role does spices play?
Well, spices are huge. And this ties into a sort of wider theme that food really informs us, which is called the death of distance. Once upon a time, distance really, where you were defined what you could eat. And one of the problems Europeans had was that they were in a part of the world where there were very few spices that could be grown. You know, horseradish is about what Europeans have if they want to add some bite to stuff. And so they wanted access to spices. But spices mostly came from Africa and the Indian Ocean. And spices are also really important in world history because spices are incredible reservoirs of value. They're unbelievably expensive. And so if you could get just one ship to the Indian Ocean and back, you could turn a massive profit from spices. And the big shift here, again, with the death of distance is, you know, once upon a time, it was hard to get spices. Now in the world we live in today, distance no longer really plays into the price of anything. And so spices are relatively cheap. But if you actually take the time to look at your food in the grocery store, you know, you'll notice that when you're buying an apple, that apple, there's a very good chance it's coming from New Zealand. And yet it doesn't cost you any more than an apple that was grown in Wisconsin.
Well, that's interesting. I think most people think their apples are coming from Michigan. or coming from Northern Ohio, or
coming
from Washington State.
If you look at your oranges at the grocery store right now, most of them are coming from South Africa.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment today. We go now to Elizabeth in Blue Ash. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. I just want to thank your guests so much for coming on and talking to us today. And your enthusiasm is just infectious, and I love
you.
The
you should
the
see him here in the studio.
Oh, I can imagine. But I think that's such a unique way of exploring history and some of the other subjects, like chemistry, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. through food. And I was wondering if you are aware of or teach any similar courses or programs, say, in the summer for kids in junior high and high school, or if there are any other things like that in Cincinnati that you are aware of?
Wow, no, I don't know of anything like that. Although I keep having kind of a fantasy that Jim Bonnaroo from Jungle Gyms is going to call me up and ask me to come out and give a whole bunch of talks on food history. If you're out there, Jim, we can talk. But no, I think this would be, if you happen to be a educator yourself, drop me a line at my NKU email address. But I think this is a great way to get students thinking about history in different ways, and not to pick on any other history teachers, but history is often taught in staggeringly boring ways. And especially history is taught in a way that tries to accentuate differences between human beings, that somehow, the history of the United States is fundamentally different from the history of Canada, or the history of France is fundamentally different from the history of Germany, or something like that. And one of the great things about food is food cuts across all those boundaries we've sort of imposed on history and complicates them. I mean, it tells us all kinds of stuff that now at the Northern Kentucky University Student Union, you can get sushi. That means that the world has changed radically in just the past 30 years.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Our number again is 513-419-7100 if you have a question or a comment. What about if you're looking through history and you talk about the weather? I mean, can you learn about the weather from the history
goodness.
Of food?
Oh, yeah. And, one of the really fascinating things about human beings is that we're the only creature on the planet that adapts to the environment in a way that's not physical. We adapt to the environment through culture. But we also change the environment by creating cultivars and domesticating animals, too. I mean, none of the animals that we keep in farms now are really natural anymore. They're all radically different from what their wild variants were. But the other fascinating thing is that the environment pushes back against human beings, and it's always throwing us curves. And so, what you can grow where is a result of the environment. And, sometimes the earth gets colder and you can't grow stuff in a particular region anymore. And sometimes the earth gets warmer. And for the same reason, you can't grow stuff there anymore because it's now too hot. And, one of the big intersections of food history is with environmental history as well.
So what do you know? Are there any particular points in history where groups of people really moved because they couldn't grow food anymore?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Probably the one that would be most familiar to us is what we think of barbarian invasions of Rome by Germanic tribes. That was really sparked by a fairly dramatic cooling of the earth that began about the 3rd century CE. And what that meant was that populations living in Northern Europe, and for that matter also in Northern Asia, could no longer practice sedentary agriculture. You could not grow. The earth cooled about 3 degrees. During that period. And what that created was basically a giant environmental refugee crisis that pushed all these populations out of Northern Europe, and all these Nordic sort of proto-German populations had to abandon sedentary agriculture and shift over to pastoralism. And they moved south. And when they moved south, they banged up against the Roman Empire. And that's why we get the Goths and the Ostrogoths and the Vandals and the eventual sack of Rome and such as that. It's also, by the way, what pushes the Turks and Mongols out of Mongolia at much about the same time and results in the Mongol invasions of Asia and Europe as well.
Andy's calling from Sims Township. Hi, Andy. What's your question?
Yes, so I was interested. So you talked about beer being a big component to creating civilization. My question is there any thought on when people started creating recipes in history? Like, beer is a pretty complex thing to make, right? So who got the idea of, or when did they get the idea to actually make the beer, and how does that happen, if there's any idea on that?
Oh, that's a great question. The oldest breweries we have are in Egypt. I believe there's one in Hierakonpolis, which is on the Upper Nile around modern-day Thebes in Egypt. And the brewery there is dated to about 3,500 BCE. So that's over 5,000 years ago. And interestingly enough, it was a commercial brewery. It was producing about 1,500 liters of beer a day. Now, as for written recipes, I don't know of any that we have for that, but I believe it's Dogfish Brewing Company has a really interesting thing where they're reconstructing ancient recipes of various brews and releasing them. They've just released a Northern European brew, for example. I forget what the name of it is, but that's another great example where, you know, now we're doing, you know, sort of microscopic analysis of the residue left on the inside of cooking pots or beer vessels from 5,000 years ago, and are able to reconstruct basically what that beer recipe was, or that wine recipe as well.
My goodness. Andy, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. We go now to Bill in Metamora. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
Just fine. What's your question?
Well, I read a book sometime back called Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, and I was wondering how you feel that fits in with your hypothesis and whatnot.
Well, first of all, let me just say how much historians like me hate Jared Diamond, because he's a biologist. In fact, he's an ornithologist, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for history. And that just really sticks in our craw. No, Jared Diamond's a really smart guy. And while I have certain problems with some elements of his argument, we won't go into that here. Jared Diamond is an example of somebody who took food and the environment really seriously and really changed the way we thought about world history as a result. And what I like most about Jared Diamond's argument in Guns, Germs, and Steel is he says two things that are crucial to his argument. The first is that different parts of the world get a different dealing of the environmental deck. If you think about taking wild plants and wild animals and turning them into domesticated plants and domesticated animals, you can't domesticate every kind of animal. Some things like goats and sheep are pretty easy to domesticate, and other things like zebras are basically impossible to domesticate just on the basis of their sort of characteristics. And Jared Diamond points out that some parts of the world, particularly Eurasia, get a great dealing of like the easy to domesticate animal deck. And they get a great dealing of the big wild grasses like wheat and barley and things like that. Other parts of the world get a very poor dealing of the environmental deck. Probably the best example of that would be Australia. There is only one domesticated crop that comes out of Australia, and that is macadamia nuts. And so the early human populations in Australia, what we call, you know, Australian Aboriginals, had none of the raw materials that you could turn into domesticated animals or domesticated crops. So they remained foragers, not because they weren't really smart people, but because the environmental raw materials just weren't there. The other thing that Jared Diamond points out is that crops move much more easily horizontally across the world because they're moving through sort of similar environmental zones. So things spread especially easy across Afro-Eurasia, but they don't spread easily north and south across Africa or up and down the Americas.
Bill, thanks so much for your call. One last call. This is Curtis from Anderson. Hi, Curtis.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hey.
What's your question?
Hi, Professor. I was wondering, would you please share your thoughts on how our approach to food and eating within our culture, the changes that have occurred from now we approach the way we eat more for pleasure as opposed to eating for fuel and sustenance.
Yeah,
you got about a minute here.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I, you know, one of the things that has really, there are two things I'd say have really transformed the way we eat. One is the crunch of time that a sort of modern industrial society puts on us. And most people just don't have time to cook anymore. And so we grab hamburgers and we order pizzas because we're rushing in and out, either, you know, going to our jobs or taking our kids to karate or whatever. The other thing is, though, that I think we should appreciate just how unbelievably wealthy we have become in many parts of the world, and that's a result of successful you know, sedentary agriculture and a very successful approach to creating huge amounts of food. But it's also dangerous because, you know, our bodies crave salt and fat and sugar, but we really don't need that much of them.
Curtis, thanks so much for your call. And Jonathan, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, a pleasure.
We really appreciate it. We've been talking about how to study history through food. My guest was Northern Kentucky University Professor of History, Dr. Jonathan Reynolds. In a moment, we'll talk about the possibility Kentucky will pass a statewide smoking ban in public buildings. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.